Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
I'm Charles Pryor, and you're listening to New Books in British Studies. It's a podcast on the New Books Network. Early American colonialism is often distinguished by an urban and rural divide. Urban development was a sign of imperial progress. British writers frequently boasted about the size of early Boston and Philadelphia while mocking the scattered settlements of the French. Colonial founders characterized their social experiment as a city on a hill, and texts that promoted colonization listed the size and location of a growing number of principal towns and cities. Outside the confines of cities, lay different places, the backcountry of settlement and Indian War, an unmapped landscape of forests and rivers. If the town stood out as a site of ordered settlement, the wilderness remained a place of mystery and danger. Paul Musselwhite is Associate Professor of History at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. In Urban Dreams, Rural Commonwealth, The Rise of Plantation Society in the Chesapeake, he challenges the conventional view of the Chesapeake as a rural society of tobacco and slavery that prevented the development of towns and cities. He shows that contemporaries argued about urban development in ways that intersected with wider discussions of the political and commercial order of the Chesapeake and its place in theories of commerce and the state in Britain between the early 17th century and the American Revolution. Paul Musselwhite joins me from Hanover. Welcome to the podcast, Paul.
Hi, thank you. Thank you for having me.
So the book had its origins in the study of medieval and early modern Europe. Can you tell us a little bit more about those roots?
Sure. So I had actually studied a lot of medieval and early modern European history as an undergraduate, and I had almost been tempted to move in that direction for my own career. And so when I became a graduate student teaching early American history, and TAing and assisting in classes, I was always overzealous in wanting to teach medieval Europe, and also kind of working with the medievalists at my graduate institution, looking for recommendations and new work and these kinds of things while I was beginning to pursue early America. And I distinctly remember one day discussing with a group of undergraduates about the relationship between cities and kingship and cities before states, and I was trying to help them to understand this, and it struck me that what I was talking about here, this unique position of cities in medieval and early modern Europe, didn't jive at all with work that I was then doing, trying to understand early Carolina and early Chesapeake society. And because, as you noted, these are places that we traditionally see as lacking any kinds of cities, and we tell the story as one where they just don't, they just never really develop. And so I started looking around to see, well, are there any echoes at all of some of these older ideas about cities and towns in these colonies? And so I was struck by the whole length of number of legislative acts that are passed in Virginia and in Maryland around trying to develop towns, and I turned to one from 1706, so 100 years after the foundation of Virginia, and find that Robert Beverly, one of the symbols of the planter aristocracy by the 18th century, is shepherding through this piece of legislation that proposes establishing towns with these people called benchers and brethren assistants of the guild hall, and this whole elaborate architecture of urban corporate governance. And I recognize that this is actually, that all of these pieces of legislation have been there all along. We've tended to dismiss them as just oddities and peculiarities. But through the 17th century, they actually form a pattern, this persistent focus on different forms of urban governance through all these pieces of legislation. And this is just at this moment when our traditional story of the Chesapeake tells us that elite planters are trying to carve out their place and relating themselves to poorer ordinary people and transitioning to slavery. And they're also engaged in this whole process of debating urban constitutionalism, which we've totally overlooked. So it came out of that medieval and early modern study and looking for those particular features in the colonial era, and actually being surprised that I found far more of them than I was initially expecting.
So when I began to teach overviews of colonial history, and I guess when I was reading set texts in colonial history, I won't name any of them, but we can all guess what they were. I always thought of the Chesapeake as a little slice of England. It was, yes, it was rural, it was aristocratic, it was heavily Anglican, it was monarchical. So it's heavily inflected by English traditions and English values. So how wrong was I?
On one level, you weren't wrong at all. That it certainly is, by absolute terms, very rural. All of the social history that was done in the 70s and 80s, you know, definitively proves that this is a place with really low population densities, and that rings true to what contemporaries themselves are observing. They're saying, actually, you know, this is a dangerously rural place. They pick it out and say, you know, that we're uniquely failing here. They're looking around the British Atlantic world, and they're looking particularly at the Spanish colonial America, and they're saying, well, we don't have towns in the Chesapeake, and this is our particular failing. But as to that question of traditional values, then, the idea that the Chesapeake is just a reflection of English traditional values, that's where I think we've become stuck, because we tend to see those traditional values as being something that are aside from politics, that there is a deeper level of culture that is not connected to the tumultuous politics of the 17th century, and so therefore the idea of the way that agriculture happens, the way that the common fields versus enclosure, and questions about county governance and the power of the gentry and the power of the nobility, and questions about feudal rights, that all of those things, and then of course also questions about urban rights and urban independence vis-a-vis the emerging state, that all of those questions are kind of work on a political, on a cultural level, that people just bring them with them as uncontested issues. But actually, they're all being hotly contested in England. And so when they're brought to America, it's unsurprising that some people are certainly bringing with them ideas about manorial, rural traditions, and the Anglican Church. But plenty of other people are bringing other ideas too. And so it's the contest of those things that actually forges the plantation society in the Chesapeake. It's not that they are predestined to be rural in any particular way, but that they end up being rural, particularly so, and even, you know, distinctly so. This doesn't look like English manorial countryside any more than it looks like a big urban center. It's plantation society is a unique new formation, and it's a product of the intersection of all of these different visions about how politics and society are going to work in the 17th century.
Oh, so that raises a question that I kind of want to follow up on, if I can, and that is the question about the chronology of the book is quite broad. It covers the period from the formation of colonies very, very early on, right through the 18th century, and the epilogue takes us to the Revolution. We tend to think of colonial formation as an act in time that is discrete, presto, a colony is founded. But this book really shows that colonies shift over time and are driven by an internal argument, the likes of which this book is concerned with. What are the general phases of, if you like, the transformation of the Chesapeake as we go through this period? Are there broad divisions that we can identify?
So I think there are a few distinct moments, and I don't the way that the book is structured, I tend not to think of it in terms of eras so much as the inflection points that sit between them. And I think that that we see an early inflection point right around the late 1610s, early 1620s, when the company's initial plans and the way they think that they're going to marry their commercial vision with the interests of colonists on the ground all starts to come to into conflict, and you get these crises that ultimately bring down the Virginia Company. And then you have another era, if you like, in the sort of second quarter of the 17th century, where I think there is a tremendous amount of uncertainty about where power lies within a colonial context and how exactly these colonies are going to be governed. And we see this particularly in Maryland, and that's partly to do with the questions about the legitimacy of Lord Baltimore because of his Catholicism in the wake of all of the the conflicts, obviously, around the English Revolution. But those questions are not simply rooted in, for example, in Baltimore's legitimacy, but they are rooted in questions about how exactly Baltimore intends to govern this place. I mean, is it going to have manorialism? How are people going to get hold of land? How is representation going to work? How is he going to control commerce? And so we see, I think, a real period of uncertainty in the middle of the 17th century that gives way to one where you're increasingly in the second half of the 17th century seeing a more straightforward divide between local elites and metropolitan officials about the purpose and nature of colonial governance and the structure and by extension, not simply the purpose and nature, not simply the center-periphery relationship, but that drills down into exactly how the colonies are going to be structured because that actually affects the center-periphery relationship. It's not simply a matter of high politics. It's about local formation. And so you get metropolitan and colonial perspectives. And then the book really then focuses at the end on the way in which the 18th century, the largest planters in the Chesapeake have really won the argument. And they've done so by structuring the society around their own estates and their own political vision. And so the era, what we think of as the golden age of the Chesapeake planter in the mid 18th century is one that is a function of everything that has gone before. And planters have worked out a relationship to the state, which facilitates enslavement of Africans, facilitates the aggrandizement of large pieces of land, and so forth. And it's only then that they fully construct this vision of a sort of rural idyll with manors and big plantations. But they do that in response to their success in many respects.
Right. So the plantation, I just want to sort of highlight three themes that are sort of cut across the book and emerge from the discussions about urbanization that it examines. And the first has to do with, I suppose, the most prominent element of the Chesapeake, and that's going to be plantation commerce. So what is the link between plantations on one hand and towns on the other in contemporary debates on how to shape and control commerce?
Plantations, the first thing to recognize is that plantations and towns are initially understood to be the same thing, right? The earliest Virginia Company tracts about the colony actually assume that a plantation is a community, is a civic unit that that actually probably is centered around a town, and that it has an urban core that gives it that is part of its structure, but its legitimacy is rooted in the fact that the plantation is a community, and so it makes sense then that a lot of people who are building large estates see the necessity of building their own town as a way of organizing their local community. They're not seeing their plantation as a purely private estate. They're seeing it as the center of a nexus of social and economic relationships in their community. And then so they want to build a town to cement that, and to give it a center where they can actually control a market, regulate trade that moves through it. And so the regulation of trade is supposed to happen through a town. I mean, this is the entire vision of what constitutes legitimacy in organization of trade in Europe, that it has to happen within a set physical space of a town. It is only gradually, as the state comes in and says that it wants to, and the imperial state comes in and says that it wants to have some degree of control over a town or urban functions and trade in the mid-17th century, beginning with the Navigation Acts, seeking to manipulate the economic system of empire, that towns start to become these critical flashpoints of division then between the center and the colony over the shape and control of commerce, and then planters increasingly think about their own plantations as being an alternative in some respects to the town as a unit of regulation, and they develop out the theories of their plantation as a political space, as a form of society that gives them legitimacy to regulate commerce themselves rather than relying upon towns and cities.
As someone who's done a lot of work on the history of political thought myself, I was sort of struck. I mean, I haven't read as much urban history as I probably should have, and I promise to read more if any of it is as good as this is. But what really struck me was how there is so much politics and there is so much political theory in these conversations. And one of the implications of your argument, and one of the things that you seem to be wanting to say to people who are doing urban history more broadly, is that they need to pay closer attention to questions of law, questions of constitutionalism, and questions of ideology. Why do you argue that?
Well, at its root, a city kind of has this long-standing associations with the core ideas of Western Aristotelian political thought. The idea that the city is the core unit for the establishment of civic virtue, for what makes a community, and so a city is a model for that. And so when we're looking to understand how that evolves in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, we really need to understand the local reality on the ground in a city to understand how those ideas are being negotiated with the larger state. So when we tell stories, and so in some respects, I'm actually arguing this the opposite way around, which is why other people need to pay more attention to urban history, and why the historians of political thought need to pay more attention to urban history, that the realities worked out on the ground around jurisdiction and law matter for these larger questions of the emergence of state structures and the battle over this. And I think European historians, to some extent, have known that for a while, but colonial historians and historians of the British Empire more generally have tended to see urban spaces as ones that are just created pragmatically on the periphery. But at the same time, to switch that around and to answer the question about why urban historians need to pay closer attention to the law and constitutionalism, I think the opposite holds true, which is that to understand the experience of ordinary people in towns and cities that are not the elites and the planners. And when we focus on like urban architecture or economic development, we tend to focus on the wealthy merchants and the urban planners. But one of the things that oddly, I think that focusing on politics and constitutionalism does is gives a voice to and an understanding of the political vision of ordinary people who may or may not choose to live in towns. And so what I'm particularly keen to do in the book is to emphasize that the decisions that ordinary people made about whether they would relocate to one of these proposed new towns or how they would trade once they got into one of those places, how they would acknowledge or not acknowledge the authority of or the legal authority of a particular market as a legal space that you had to trade your tobacco, for example, that those acts of daily life actually constituted political action. Once you understand the legal and political ramifications of urban identity and charters and their relationship to other forms of colonial sovereignty and imperial sovereignty, you then see the actions of people who haven't left us that many written sources, poorer planters, urban craftsmen, even the actions of the enslaved, for example, as responses to that, to those bigger questions about mercantilism that we tend to leave those people out of.
Mm. So that's that perspective. You've used the word local a number of times as we've had this discussion, and I'm struck. And you quote in the book work by Lauren Benton, and increasingly, the history of early America has gone through a number of sort of discussions about scope and size, from Atlantic to Pacific to Oceanic to continental and back again. Now it seems that the local is back with a vengeance, and that all imperial politics somehow has a local dimension. So the discussion about urban spaces is one of those local spaces. That's essentially the argument that we're getting here.
Yeah, I think that the local, I think it's not so much purely a return to the local and a return to the community studies that were done in the 60s and 70s and the very detailed social history, but it is a recognition of the complicated relationship between the local and the global, right? And the way in which each community is wrestling with these larger questions and has its own perspective on them, and that people's individual understandings of the way that the state worked were constructed by their experience of their particular community or however they defined that, and that the process of defining that is actually a process of defining how they fit within the larger imperial structure. And I think to some extent, it even has a reflection on, it's really a reflection of contemporary issues and our increasing uncertainty about the nation state, right? We're telling stories now that don't center the nation, but also don't center abstract global forces, because over the last 10 years or so, we've seen that people in society, in contemporary society, are yearning to understand the relationship between local dynamics and globalization. And so in breaking away from the nation state, we're actually telling stories about communities that and providing a usable past for understanding communities that governed in ways before the nation, and how local communities structured themselves before the sort of monopoly of the state and the nation in the mid to late 18th century.
So the last theme then that I want to pick up is republicanism, mm-hmm. Which is, in a lot of ways, you know, the ideology of the Civitas, the local ideology of the defined Republic of Citizens. But how does this work And how does your work in particular seek to change how we understand republicanism in early America, and particularly its agrarian dimensions? Mm.
Yeah, so in some respects, it feels, when I began to recognize, even as a grad student, that this work kind of spoke to this long tradition of writing about republicanism and in early American history, you approach that with some trepidation, because of course there is a huge literature on the Republican synthesis, as it's called, around the American Revolution, but a lot of that work really roots the story in the 18th century, emerging out of imported ideas from Europe, and because it doesn't look back to the 17th century, partly out of a trepidation about the potential for a sort of Whiggish narratives that find its origins right in the earliest general assemblies and government structures, that we see this inevitability of the American story, the rise of republicanism, and so they instead focus on these sorts of the broader socio-political trends in colonial America that give rise to that make people very receptive to Republican thought when it sort of appears as an import from England in the sort of second quarter of the 18th century. And what I am trying to do, and so in that respect, it then becomes kind of odd that it becomes so much a focus of agrarianism and a particularly appealing to Chesapeake planters, who of course become the vanguard of these Republican ideologies at the time of the American Revolution. So what I try to do is actually give a much more complicated backstory to the way that Republicanism has many roots in the early Chesapeake, and that they become tied to agrarianism at various moments, and they don't necessarily they become connected to agrarianism in a way that is uniquely American and is not simply a kind of an import from Europe. And so initially, republicanism is, as you said, kind of tied to the idea of the city and the civitas of a city, and it becomes so connected with rurality by the 18th century, but it does that through this process by which the virtues and advantages of the city as a unit that promotes civic participation, political legitimacy, become stripped away and are replaced by this vision of rurality. And so the plantation really comes to take on a lot of the virtues and a lot of the Republican associations for Southern planters that the city had previously held, and that I think is the way we actually understand republicanism as a deep and complex intertwining into English American colonial experience, without making it a Whiggish story that it arrives at the beginning and kind of just gradually emerges into the American Revolution.
Just a little bit more on republicanism, because it's I think it's maybe an important point to sort of tease out. And I just wonder, do you find a tension between this agrarian inflected republicanism and the fact that these people were also slave owners?
They don't feel like they can move all the way to the conception of their plantation as being a Republican unit in some respects, actually, ironically, until they move in the early 18th century entirely over to, or almost entirely over to a slave-based economy. And so there's actually not so much a tension, but a way in which when plantations are units within these more complicated county neighborhood structures, where they actually have to balance the interests of various people, and their own economic position is a little uncertain and unstable, then they have difficulty kind of envisioning their own individual estates as having particular legitimacy to speak to the state directly, because they recognize the complexity of relationships that that make up the community. But then once they move, and I think around the pivot of the 18th of the turn of the 18th century, to a full-scale model of slavery, they begin to articulate this vision that they have for the economic independence necessary, that their plantations really represent distinct economic units, where they can speak to, where they can speak for their community and to the state directly. So I think in that sense, slavery is essential to the way in which plantations, private plantations, can claim the legitimacy of a civic unit, where previously individual estates could never quite seem like they were the equivalent of a town or city, because they didn't have that, that they were always economically dependent, obviously, upon larger structures, the town and the city, and the market through, and the town and the city kind of mediate the market, right, for a plantation. But once you get into the 18th century, planters with the large enslaved populations feel confident that they can make their own, they can make their own deals. They've got their own enslaved population. They've got guaranteed supplies of commodities. And you get this emergence of self-confident planters who claim that they have the economic power to regulate for their community and to deal directly with the state in a way that they have never quite felt like they had in the 17th century.
I've been speaking to Paul Musselwhite, the author of Urban Dreams, Rural Commonwealth, The Rise of Plantation Society in the Chesapeake, which is published by the University of Chicago Press. It's comprehensively researched and crisply written. And I thank you, Paul, for taking the time to speak to me on the podcast today.
Thank you.